please do sign in. Thank the co-sponsors of today's talk, the MSU Asian Studies Center, the MSU Center for Gender and Global Context, and the MSU Women's Resource Center. Now, the talk today, and let me quickly just recognize that one of our earliest Brown Bag speakers when we started this series long ago was Vivian Hickson, so I'm very happy to have her today in the audience. Vivian happens to be one of the most talented cartoonists commenting on the situations within higher education. Many of her cartoons have been carried in the Chronicle of Higher Ed, among other kinds of things. We were happy to have her as an early Brown Bag speaker. It's great to have her here today. So, you know, the when I first heard the term precarious work, really comes through a lot of the internet within or across the globe. And precarious work really is about the whole notion of that with temporary employment, with part-time employment, with really living hand-to-mouth and at the edge of the labor market, there's real great interest in precarious work at this point. But people are also organizing around issues of precarious work, trying to organize to gain power, to gain solidarity, to gain various things. Today we're going to hear about that a bit in terms of the Self-Employed Women's Association of India. Our speaker, Chaudhary, is speaking on the topic organizing in a precarious world of work, the Self-Employed Women's Association of India. Shoma finished her PhD at Vanderbilt University in the department there. She's a professor here in the sociology department here at Michigan State University. And so we're very, very happy to have Shoma with us today. So please help me in welcoming Shoma to speak on her topic. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John, and thank you, everybody, for coming on this wonderful February day in Michigan. Today, I will be talking about SEWA, or the Self-Employed Women's Association, also known as SEWA. This is a part of a project which doesn't have, which does not really deal with organization, but it deals with organization against domestic violence. So it doesn't deal with organization of work, but deals with domestic violence. So when I first spoke to John about ideas of presenting here, you know, I told him that you know, I can talk about SEWA, but I don't really work in the labor part of the SEWA. But John suggested that I present sort of this how SEWA organizes, and maybe through this I can also have some feedback as to how I can utilize this organization into my own project against domestic violence. Let me start with what is it that I study, particularly through SEWA. What is it that I want to do? So in India, for those of you who are very familiar with India, India has very sophisticated laws against domestic violence. India is also one of those countries where violence against women rates are very high. And she has very sophisticated laws. But when it comes to implementation, that's when problem starts. Particularly problematic are implementation of laws at the grassroots level. And these grassroots levels could be at the urban grassroots level, meaning especially for the sections who are among the lower classes, particularly among slum dwellers, also among street occupants, which is basically people who live on the streets, sort of not, you can call them homeless in this American context. But if you go to India, you'll see that even on walkways, you know, there are small sort of temporary housing that is made with canvas, you know, barely 10 feet by 10 feet shelters that are made. And of course, it is illegally occupied. The government uses the term illegally occupied, and they mostly compose of migrants from the rural areas. And also by grassroots, I also mean the grassroots, the people who live in rural India. So, you know, especially after passage of laws, implementation of laws, particularly in the grassroots area, is problematic because of various regions. And so what we, you know, this is a project that I am working on with Dr. Mary Morash in the School of Criminal Justice. And what we hope to look at is how women organize through NGOs such as SIVA and AWAJ, how they organize grassroots women protesting against domestic violence. So this is basically our project. And why did we select Gujarat? Now, SIVA's headquarters is in Gujarat, actually in the city of Ahmedabad. And why did we select Gujarat? There are two reasons why. One, Gujarat is just fascinating in terms of the organization and women's movements history. I mean, it is one of the states where the first trade union for women was organized. It is also one of the leaders for women's unionization in the country. At the same time, Gujarat statistics on violence against women are fairly at the higher level in terms of the national statistics. So it's very interesting how Gujarat is sort of situated. Politically, currently it is ruled by a government which is sort of embedded in controversies, including attacks on minority groups in India. So it's a very interesting sort of a case study. And in this project, we want to study women's leadership organizations, looking at two groups. One is SIVA and the other one is AWAJ, or Ahmedabad's Women's Action Group. AWAJ specifically focuses on domestic violence. SIVA doesn't really work on domestic violence, but they look at ways to unionize and to give women workers identities. Yes? Sure. Tax? No, I said, okay. Well, by minorities, I meant religious minorities, the Muslims. And the current government in Gujarat is portrayed to be anti-Muslims. You know, so this is why Gujarat is very, very fascinating. It is ruled by the BJP. The current government in power is BJP. Yes, Vivian. No, not at all. These are in fact state-supported attacks, and one of the biggest sort of riots that happened, they call it a riot among some political scholars, they call it the genocide, happened in 2002. And, you know, and the aftermaths of it, you know, we are still facing as we work on these groups, so. Okay, so now enough about my sort of work. Let me go directly into SIVA. So SIVA was founded in 1972 by a woman named Ila Bhatt. And SIVA, the idea of SIVA is the idea of ben or sisterhood. You know, in Gujarat, if you go even in formal settings for a woman, they'll call you Shoma Ben. And if you're a man, they'll call you John Bhai, which is the brother. So this is very much a part of the culture. But SIVA is very much based on the idea of sisterhood. And what they want to do is that they want to organize women who are outside the organized labor sector, meaning women who work at home. And, you know, and what is home-based work? You know, that is one of the first things that SIVA had to sort of encounter. What is home-based work? It could be tailoring, it could be even kite making, you know, and it could also be rag picking. What is rag picking? Basically, in India, in big cities, you know, the garbage and the recycle system is also managed by a very informal organization of workers who go from one garbage dump to the other, picking rags or picking glass pieces or plastic that can be recycled, you know. And so this is very much, you know, the kind of occupation that the urban poor engages in. And one of the first things that Ila noticed was that there was no unionization. Now, you know, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, India went through very interesting labor movements, you know, and unionizations and all these laws and all that was passed. But these laws did not really cover the people who are outside the formal employment, you know, and this was a problem, and especially most affected were women. And so SEWA sort of, they decided to organize the informal workers. And informal workers today in India, they composed, even today, 93% of the employment statistics. You know, that's what SEWA tells us, that it's basically 93%. I must tell you one little sort of side note, and I'm going to be recorded, and I want to work with SEWA. But the thing is that statistics, when you go to SEWA Research Center and you ask them for statistics, it is a little problematic, you know, and so often I've had very conflicting estimates of statistics from SEWA. So that's one of the things I'll have to work with. But anyway, so what SEWA wanted to do was to basically unionize them and to also build a cooperative. And this, you know, this sort of group of workers, what they also wanted to do was also to forge an identity. And today, SEWA has memberships all over India, but its strongest memberships lies with the inside Gujarat. So SEWA very consciously, opted for the term self-employed, you know, as versus marginal workers or informal workers, because they wanted to stress on the idea that these are people, particularly women, who are employing themselves at home, who are setting up their own sort of business and, you know, sort of for collective bargaining. And one very interesting feature that SEWA talks about is that these women, they are not just engaged in one single trade. So some of them could be rag pickers in the morning, and at night they can go and, you know, work on kite making at home. So they are both street workers as well as, you know, street workers as SEWA understands, as well as home-based workers. So they are all going through multiple identities. Again, very problematic outside conventional union norms. And very problematic also was the idea of minimum wage. So in India, we do have a Minimum Wage Act, but it does not apply to self-workers, you know, so that's again a problem that is happening. Okay. Next, I'll talk about collective bargaining. You know, what does SEWA sort of try to do? So they try to place the women workers at the center of the economic reform. And the sort of the philosophy behind this is that women can and do build strong, vital organizations around issues that are relevant to them, find suitable solutions out of their own experiences, and on the process change our society, environment in a healthy, respectful, non-violent, sustainable way. And so the basic philosophy is to sort of organize them, have a voice, which is very important for collective bargaining. And if you go and if you sort of engage with conversations with SEWA, they'll give you case study after case study, how this has happened. And it's not just one generation. It's like it is already going through three generations now from the 1970s. And for example, when I spoke to them, they referred to this worker. You know, this is a worker, her name is Jamu Ben, and she works in the salt mines. Now, Gujarat is very close to Pakistan. And, you know, in the border sort of districts, it is desert, and there's also a lot of salt mines that are there. And a lot of the women, they are engaged in salt mines. And so when Jamu Ben first, for example, came to SEWA, she was she had very little rights. She didn't have, much to negotiate or bargain with. But after joining SEWA, they basically talk about how now she, in addition to working at the salt mine, also is working at embroidery trade, and they are also sort of helping her to bargain and so on. And Seva has this 10-point checklist, which is, you know, if you visit their offices, there are all these big posters. And they talk about, you know, how increasing employment strategies, increasing income, improving access to nutrition, access to healthcare, childcare, housing, water and sanitation, organization, leadership, self-reliance. So this is very important, you know, especially when you talk about the poor in India. This is very important, this sort of a collective bargaining. Right. So how does this collective bargaining work, you know? So they, you know, so every member in Seva, they have a membership, right? And so which is called the general membership. And what they do is that now every member is now organized into trade. And these trades then become sort of a cooperative, and so that they can own their labor and their products. So there's no middlemen or middlewoman in this hierarchy. So all the benefits go directly to them. They're also giving access to credit, and in the next slide I'll talk about Seva banking. And currently they have around 90 different cooperatives built around products, while others are around services. So there is, you know, the cooperative of trade that is going on, and also a separate in terms of service, such as banking. Banking is more of a service. So examples of cooperatives would be vendors cooperatives. So in urban Ahmedabad, you know, there are vegetable vendors everywhere. You know, women are basically selling the vegetables on the carts, and so they could be a part of the vendors cooperatives, midwives cooperatives, rag pickers cooperatives, and weavers cooperatives, and so on. So let me talk a little bit about the banking. So Indian banks were nationalized in 1969. But when Seva went to organize, you know, banking, or, you know, sort of giving credit to its members, it faced a lot of problems. The biggest problem was prejudice, because the bank managers did not know how to give access to the urban poor. At that time, it was the urban poor that Seva was dealing with. And none of them could read or write, so even keeping, you know, the passbook account was a problem. You know, how could you do that? So Seva then became an intermediary. However, it didn't work. So in 1974, they started their own bank, where every member was required to contribute a small sum of money. At that time, it was 10 rupees. 10 rupees is a few cents, you know, which is still quite a bit of money, but still. And then within 6 months, about 80,000 rupees, which is what, around close to $2,000 was collected. And the first sort of cooperative bank, known as the Women's Cooperative Bank, was established. So it is one of the first banks of the poor. It was sometimes, and if you talk to some of the older Seva members, they'll say that this is actually even older than the Grameen Bank, you know. And so it's very, very fascinating story. Even today, if you go to a Seva bank, you'll see that now most Seva members can just sign, you know, sign their names, but that's all the literacy that they'll have. But the passbook accounts are color-coded so that they know how much of money is being transacted and all. So this is quite innovative. And today they have got, like, you know, generations of members who've got access to this. And in one of our conversations, one of the Seva bigger administrators, you know, higher up in the administration, she used this term power shakti, which is basically money generated to power, which Seva women often talks about. So I'll talk a little bit about the leadership structure. So I, you know, in the beginning I talked about how in our own project we are looking at organization against domestic violence, how Seva does that. And I mentioned how they're doing it with the help of their women leaders. Now these women leaders are ordinary members of Seva who are trained to become leaders. So how does this happen? So next thing, you know, that's what I'm going to do. You know, so at the first level, you know, at the first level of the hierarchy, this is the NGO administrators. Now they are not, I mean, they are Seva members, but they are the ones who are basically in the office. So answering email, the foundation members, and so on and so forth. So the general membership is, of course, you know, that we talked about, and they have various organizations based upon trade. Now, each trade, depending upon the number of people, they elect representatives. Okay. Now, this is basically based on the trade groups. And from those trade groups, they elect representative council against the number of members. It kind of varies from trade group to the other, you know, depending upon. And they are sort of elected for 3 years, and it's on the rotation based. And they also, the representative councils also elect executive councils. Now, these two, representative councils and executive councils, they are the ones who form the Seva leadership. You know, these are the people who, if there is a problem, in our case, you know, if suppose an incident of domestic violence has happened against a Seva member, they are the ones who will rush first and try to negotiate, you know, with the police, with the family, with the community, and they are the ones who are also not just giving advice in terms of personal matters, but also in terms of bargaining at work for better resources and so on and so forth. So this is how basically they are training generations of leadership, which is actually very fascinating. Yes, Vivian.
I'm wondering,
yes, 3 times. So it is held once every 3 years, and each term gets elected for 3 years, you know, and so it's on rotation. So I'll later on in the talk, I'll show you pictures of the leaders. I mean, these are very ordinary people. I mean, like ordinary members. Like, they will be picking rags in the morning and working on their second job in the afternoon and late. But on weekends, they take on the image of the leader. And, you know, it's just fascinating grassroots organization. And it's very unique to Seva, something that you do not see in any other model, at least I haven't seen. So it's very fascinating. This could be a project in itself, but since I'm more interested in violence, that's what appeals to me more. So, okay. So if you talk to Seva, they will always tell you about, we want our members to have empowerment, particularly economic empowerment. So what is economic empowerment? You know, we all know economic empowerment. That is, you know, access to resources would give better bargaining power. But how does this work in Seva? So in Seva, what they do is, of course, you know, since these women, they are organized around various sort of trade groups, you know, trading unions. So the first thing that they have, as soon as something that the government does not do, something that the unions do not do, that the first thing that a membership in Seva ensures that they are a part of a trade union. And so it gives them a formal identity as a worker. When Mary and I first went to visit their office last year in February, we went to the Seva reception center, which is basically their main head office, and we found women after women just making ID cards. Even when they are talking to us, they are constantly making ID cards. And, you know, basically making by meaning, you know, they're kind of filling up forms, they're stapling paper together. So it's like generations and generations of self-employed workers are getting identity as a worker, which is very important because identity ensures benefits, you know. And then, of course, a membership. And then they have the idea of sisterhood, which is basically ties into social capital, which is very important when it comes to bargaining from this sector. And it also helps them to develop leadership roles. Now, what do these leadership roles, what does it mean in terms of empowerment, you know? The first thing that it does is that it gives them physical mobility. So a number of these women, especially in the villages, even if they are working in family-based occupations, so they could work on the farmlands, or they could, you know, work on certain, you know, areas where the family allows, mobility without the permission of the family is kind of not okay. If they are going to take up leadership roles, they have to take decisions to travel by themselves. They cannot consult their families, which is actually quite innovative when it comes to empowerment for women. It also helps in developing self-esteem and and confidence. You know, when we spoke to some of these women leaders, they were talking about how previously when they would go to a meeting, they would have to lie to the family and go and say, you know, we are going to go to the market to buy stuff, and on the way we will stop by at Siva's office. But today, you know, there's a lot of confidence, and they have also managed to sort, you know, in a leadership role, you are constantly talking to the police, you are talking to the legal system, you are talking to the local governing body. So, you know, it gives them a lot of self-esteem and confidence. And it also helps in making decision-making in public spheres. You know, as you know, even, you know, India also has a very interesting grassroots democracy, you know, where women are, of course, they are members, but in most of the cases, even in panchayat meetings, that is the democracy at the grassroots levels, it's the men who, you know, speak up, not the women. I have, you know, in my previous sort of research, I've spoken to panchayat, women panchayat members who told me that they sit on the floor while the men sit on the chairs when a meeting is taking place, you know, and it's just fascinating. So, you know, when you become a leader, you know, when you are, obviously you have a social capital. That's why I find the social capital power very much more interesting than the economic empowerment. For me, that is the most sort of exciting part, you know. And so, you know, so this basically gives them a lot of, so it's not just economic empowerment. And of course, it gives them income, which is very important. So it gives them financial power, decision making within the household. So the women, you know, talked about how now, you know, their husband even escort them to the meeting if it's held later at night, and escort them back home. And support of the family and influencing the next generation. So you'll see that in Seva, it's the mother, the sister, the daughter-in-law, you know, they are all sort of members of this group. And of course the power shakti, which is also, I define it also as a formal political representation. So, you know, in many gram panchayat meetings, Seva has, even though they might not be members of the panchayat, but they will have, you know, a representative from Seva to present their demands and their concerns. So they have what the group calls also as formal political representation. They also negotiate with the police and legal system. We found that, at least in preliminary conversations, that their leaders actually accompany victims of domestic violence and also train them and also psychologically prepare them to how to deal with the police and with the legal system. And it creates a support network, you know. This is how it sort of works. Okay. So, but if you ask Seva, you know, they will talk about this very simple model that what it does for the woman. They say that it gives them economic empowerment, which definitely is a big factor in influencing decision making. As a result of this, they will have political empowerment and social empowerment. But this is the most important part in Seva. Okay. And finally, I want to talk very briefly about my project with Mary. And what is it that we want to study inside Seva? We basically want to see how the Seva women leaders are innovatively employing tactics and strategies. Remember, I talked about how India has laws, but the implementation of the laws, especially at the grassroots level, is a challenge. So how do, because you know, there is a law against domestic violence, but if you go to the rural areas, very rarely will a victim of domestic violence go and talk to the police, because she doesn't even know how to go and talk to the police. She probably knows where the police station is, and she goes to the police station, and the police men who are there, probably they don't even have a women's cell there. So there is a lot of psychological as well as social training that is needed before the victim reaches some support. So we are interested in looking at what tactics they use, you know, what innovation, and also strategies, you know. Ultimately, you know, even the family, the community, which is local government, legal courts, the police, you know, there is even in India, sort of talking against domestic violence is not widely accepted because it's very personal, it's very private. And we operate in a cultural norm where it is okay for the husband to beat the wife if the food is not hot or I mean like served warm, hot meaning served warm, or if she has been lazy, whatever lazy means, or if she has been unable to produce a son, you know. So it is okay. So even if you go to the police will often tell the woman to go back home, you know. So, but so Seva not only sort of intervenes on behalf of the victim, but they are also trying to come up with interesting strategies. What interesting, what innovative strategies are they doing to sort of communicate with all this? So this is basically our project that we are going to look at. Before I sort of end, I just wanted to show some pictures. You know, this, we, Mary and I, we took a trip together, sort of a preliminary discussion trip in February last year. And then I went back on my own again to sort of further rework some of the questions in June of last year. So this is actually the Seva Center, you know, this is, and they're all leaders, you know, these women, and they're, look at this, it's basically they're constantly filling up ID forms. Sorry, the picture is too dark here. This is actually a close up. Now these women, they are actually vegetable vendors, and I'll quickly show you. And she, Savita, this is her name, she knows how to read and write, but she didn't know prior to coming to Seva. So they're making these ID cards. And this is basically, we had a, could you turn off the lights? Maybe the photographs will be a little better. A little better. So they are all basically leaders. You know, we were in a round table conversation with them for 3 hours. It's very interesting, you know. They even told us a very interesting thing. They said that prior to coming to Seva, they would cover their head. So this, a piece of the sari would go on their head. But now, because of the leadership positions and all, you know, they even dress very differently, you know. So which is very interesting to us. This is, you know, just a small sort of, sorry for the bad picture, but I wanted to show you some of the posters that are all over the Seva reception center that talks about the 11-point scale that, and it's in Gujarati and it's Hindi and it's in English for us. Seva, you know, of course, sees itself as a banyan tree, which is basically a massive tree with many roots and branches. And I wish we had taken a better picture next time, but they talk about the various sort of organizations that they're doing. This is when they took us to meet, meet two young Seva vendors. So she's the main owner of this cart. She's Muslim. And that's why, you know, I mentioned about the political sort of climate. You know, Seva also organizes with, you know, it has both Muslim and Hindu memberships. Particularly in this current political climate in that state, there has been constant incidents where Muslims are discriminated by the government. So they are Muslims and they own this vegetable cart. Well, I'll show you the next click. Maybe we have a, yeah, this is another woman. This is exactly how the cart looks like, you know. And as you can see, you know, they really don't have licenses from the government. So because, you know, this is all in the informal sector. And, you know, she has her cart in front of a store. You know, I think it was a hardware store or something. And often the hardware store complains to the police saying that we need to remove the cart. So the police comes, gets the cart away, and, you know, and of course she never gets back her stuff. So Seva sort of intervenes and helps. And I think the next picture is that of a woman. Yeah, her cart was taken away, you know, I think 2 weeks ago from her, and the police also took away all the produce, and she was very much harassed. But now she's actually been able to set up her business again on the footpath. So what else? Yeah, this is basically a group meeting of a leadership group meeting that takes place. They are all executive council members and women of all ages and of all backgrounds. That's all. That's all that I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I've got all sorts of questions. I'm sure other people do too. But let me open it up first. Questions. Well, let me start off with one.
that argues for kind of continuing education, making myself a better embroidery artist, and also issues of quality, that is, how do we standardize, or do we even standardize around the issues of quality, or the issues of what's selling versus what's not selling currently?
Yeah, though this is not my area, I must say, as I said, you know, I'm more interested in the domestic violence negotiation, but we did talk about. So one of the things that SEWA, if you look at their 11 prong, you know, point steps, they definitely emphasize on education. And they are also, you know, there's this constant sort of, conversations on collectively bargain, meaning that if we are going to sell our produce to the middlemen, how much of money should we sort of ask for, and also, so yes, so there is a constant sort of conversations on that. Quality control, they talk a lot about quality control. Unfortunately, I cannot comment on that. I don't know anything about it, but they talk a lot about collective bargaining, sort of enforcing a minimum sort of an acceptable wage, you know, whatever, whether it falls under Minimum Wage Act or not, I can't comment on that. That's not really my area. But they're very, very conscious of their rights. And they're very, it's interesting, you know, and I often go back to, because I'm more interested in the domestic violence negotiations, so I ask them, you know, suppose if some of your sisters, you know, one of your sisters has sister, meaning sister of SEWA, has an incident, what do you do? And they said, oh, we all go as a group together. So, you know, so this is this constant sort of collective bargaining that goes on. And I'm, and of course, this is a part of it, but that's... Speak up. First and foremost, India is very diverse. So what, you know, what happens in the Himalayan area is probably a little different. What is going on in Gujarat, but I can comment on the broader trends. So it's very patriarchal, you know. So even when I did my, you know, my previous research is on witchcraft accusations. That's what I spent the last few years of my academic career studying. So even if I would go and talk to a victim, survivor, she would never speak up. It would be her brother or her, and it would always be a group conversation going on. So, you know, of course it has, of course being a qualitative interviewer, I had to develop that trust. I had to develop that level of comfort so that she would speak to me privately. What happens in the panchayats, at least in Gujarat, at least what we've been hearing is that it's very much male dominated. And it is also organized on the basis of caste hierarchy, you know. And caste is very regional and very sort of, there are numerous subgroups and all of, so there's a lot of complexities that are going on. For women, women are constitutionally guaranteed, you know, they are members, and there's also a reservation of seats in the panchayat system. I think now, what, 30%? 30%, no? 30%, so they have to, women have to be members. So most often, even though they are members, and they could be even a panchayat leader, you know, like this woman leader I was interviewing for my other project, she kept on telling me, what can I do? They only keep me, you know, they just silence me and they keep on talking. So what I found at least is that individually they are like individual members, you know, who are members of the panchayat. But when the seva presence, you know, started happening, they become a collective. And so with the collective, they have a collective voice. And that's why I talked about self-confidence, self-esteem. You talked about introductions, you know, introductions. So I also asked my group to introduce themselves. This was basically even after, you know, they were all leaders, but you know, so they would, you would imagine them to be very confidently, you know, introducing themselves. But in Gujarat, it's a very interesting name structure. So, for example, I'm Shoma Chaudhary, but in Gujarat, I became Shoma Orjit Mukherjee Chaudhary. Orjit Mukherjee is my husband's name, okay? And so it's very interesting. And in the Indian culture, the very virtuous Indian woman doesn't take her husband's name. It is improper to take her husband's name. So she would introduce herself as, for example, Savita, and then she would go up into a burst of giggles. Till it's very interesting what the other members were like, you can't afford to giggle, say your name with pride. And so there was this constant sort of collective, you know, which is this collective pressure sort of that was going on, which is just fascinating. And that's why, you know, Mary and I, when we thought of this project, we thought that, you know, it'll be very cool to study, you know, how they are, you know, sort of negotiating and how they are coming up with innovative ways to sort of address domestic violence. Does that make sense, sort of? So, but it's very much cultural, you're right. Yeah, of course, because, you know, first and foremost, the government considers all these operations to be illegal. They don't have licenses, you know, for license to operate, yes, right? Because license would ensure that you have, you know, what should I say, that you have an identity within the formal sector, which they don't have. It is Seva who gives them the identity. It's not the government. So when I talk about formal membership, it is the Seva membership. So there's no license, you know, it is all illegal cart, you know, the government considers it to be illegal cart. So they're constantly getting into conflict with the police. So every week they have to bribe the police. Every week. No, every week. But despite that, one complaint from the shopkeeper, they'll come and they'll confiscate the cart. And this poor woman probably loses her entire week's income in that. And it's this constant cycle of brutality. You know, when we went to talk to them, the Seva administrators, they were constantly pushing us to study police brutality. You know, maybe some other project we'll do. But yes. First and foremost, collective, because they are members of Seva, they have a collective sort of group that will go to the police station. They will make sure that the cart is basically given back to the woman. They will pay fines, you know, and sometimes the police are also, I found the police a little intimidated by Seva also, because of this, because it's a 40-year-old organization. And they have a huge clout, so, you know, it's very interesting, a group, I mean, and so they will go, and they will also help the woman to sort of reset her business again. So it, at this point, it was on the street, but hopefully she'll get her cart back. And often, you know, police, they beat, or, you know, they physically assault, even sexually also assault. So Seva will go and lodge complaints, you know, and do all this. You know, you see, for the poor to go up to an administrator and to say that he or she's been wrong, it's a big deal. Because, you know, the way it is, bureaucracy is set up, it's almost sort of preventing you from lodging a complaint. So it's just fascinating how the organization is working, especially in this sector, you know.
Cheryl, can you tell us a little bit about women? How many of these are single women? How many of these are widows? I mean, you pointed to the young Muslim woman who is a mother and probably a wife as well and is a street vendor. But break down that group for us. Do you have any idea about what you're looking at?
Not at the moment, but I would say it has memberships of all, I mean, of all categories, widows, mothers, young single women, married women, you know. We even, I mean, divorced women, you know. Divorce in this culture is a taboo, right? Seva even helped to get divorces, you know, if required. For example, the husband is just bad or abusive or just disappeared for 7 years. So legally, he can be declared as dead so that she can get, you know, get on with her lives and all. No, I can't, you know, so that's the problem with Seva statistics, I must say. So with this organization, are you going to put this on a website?
Well, and let me just follow up. I do work in Africa, and so that the idea that you might have, for example, street vendors, where the only thing between them and total poverty, if they're an individual woman that's a widow or whatever, is the business that they're running. And therefore, many of your older Seva, they were older women.
Right.
You know, so that the issue is how that hierarchy works out, whether or not you have a lot of women for whom the organization, in effect, has taken the place of family.
And
other kinds of bonds and networks that they
Of course. Yes, this, I mean, Seva, I mean, as I mentioned, they talk about the sisterhood a lot, you know. And so it's definitely, I mean, they talk about, I mean, John, when you go to visit Seva, you'll find generations of women. So the mother is there, the daughter is there, the daughter, I mean, even the grandchild who's barely into her teens, she's also there. So they have become sort of a family. And I call it the social capital, which is going on, very, very powerful, sort of, especially in organizing this group.
Even though their small entrepreneurial activities are considered illegal, if they develop more skills in organization, could that the income from that be a basis of power?
Of course. Yeah, that is one of the things that they are constantly sort of sort of pushing the people forward. So for example, I mentioned the story of Mujabu Ben, who used to be just a salt worker. So every day in the morning, she would go to the mines, gather some salt on her head. So I mean, it's like numerous trips, back and forth, back and forth. So after she became a member of the Seva, she also started doing embroidery work. Of course, that takes time and skill. It was painful for her, and she mentioned how painful it was. But now she also has a side business to sort of supplement that. Kite making, you know, paper kites, very cheap, and it's an industry which is also where women are at work, you know. So these are sort of supplement, I mean, sort of second sort of jobs that they hold on. So they just do not have one sort of occupation that they start with to continue. So Seva, definitely this organization, they are sort of trying to encourage them to diversify their talents, also bring in more sort of, bring in more income into the family, more stability of income, because the salt mines, it's not operational all the time of the year. So, but you know, I mean, I must say this about Seva, they only go, they are very much concentrated upon the economic empowerment, you know, that's the goal. They think if you give the woman economic empowerment, the rest solves. The other group that I'm looking at, they actually go with much more of a social and cultural empowerment. So it's really very cool for our project to see how two models of empowerment are actually achieving the same results, but how are they doing it? then of course all of them are very related.
One caller seemed just to, again, I kind of hinted at it before, but in Mondragon, which is the northern Basque region of Spain, there's a whole group of cooperatives that were set up there long ago, and it's an unbelievably vibrant area. And so when you look at this notion of nested cooperative development, often what you could do, I mean, many of these women are doing street selling so that they, you know, their market is local.
Right.
But let's take the example of embroidery. You know, if their cooperative could put a number of those embroideries together, send them to the United States, and in effect, have a marketing end here, 10,000 villages or any of the other kinds of the places where such can be sold. I mean, that I guess it's at the issue of what is their engine. If they regard their market as totally local,
they have been very clever, you know. Sarah has connection with Harvard University. So, you know, we tried very hard to bring them on campus to just, you know, for a talk. There are some of our colleagues in the College of Education and James Madison, Linda Rashiopi, Amita Chitkar, who tried to bring them, but we couldn't find dates because they were busy in Harvard. So hopefully in the next trip they'll come to us. But they have very strong sort of, I mean, it's a 40-year-old organization. So they've been very innovative in terms of developing. And you know, the other day we were, when I was visiting them, they were showing me products made out of waste paper that they are going to sell at Staples. And that Staples has basically commissioned them to produce this stuff. And it's very fascinating how much they have done for the, in terms of organization. Of poor women, poor self-employed women, who is now, and the bank is also a big deal, you know. I didn't even talk in details about the bank, but it's just fascinating. Churches?
Yeah, that's right. There's some social scientist churches in the United States that try to buy products from cooperatives stores. I don't know if it makes any difference. I don't know. They didn't notice that another difference.
I must say they've also got a lot of prominence, you know. Outside, I mean, they also have centers in Africa, and I think in South America they have some centers, very small centers, but they have centers. So maybe that's an organization thought. But,
any other questions?
We could do a project on that. You know, they kept on telling me that.
I find that so fascinating and scary and disconcerting.
Okay.
Certainly in this year's community-wide, hopefully from beyond the world, wherever there's good insight into the way police and legal systems operate, with it's just in the bribery and the intimidation are just built into the system.
Right.
Everybody knows what that is, and so we plan for that.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I can't imagine how intimidating it must be in that culture for women who are of low economic caste. We have an experience, one of my co-leaders, tall, very tall, white gentleman, was pickpocketed on a very divided metro. It was a gang, three or four people.
What a must be a very horrible experience.
It was terrible.
Yeah.
The first street officer, the Metro Police, was very, very kind, supportive, directed to
conjecture is that if they said that it was robbed, then they would have to do legwork, which they didn't want to do. They just don't want to do it. Whereas if they say that, oh, I lost it, okay, lost it, we don't even have to report that. And it's probably also because they were probably getting some money from those gangs, you know? So they know which gang operates. I mean, they might be corrupt, but they're very well networked. So they don't have to go and rescue.
So I've heard many, that was just a personal experience. Right. We've heard many other personal things. I've certainly read about that. I've heard books on the newspaper that it's just so widespread.
Right.
I guess my question is, how do you even begin to address a system like that? Why do you have to lose?
It's a very good question. As I said, I study violence against women, and a lot of the interviews and cases that I encounter is when rape victims, they go to the police station. It's a horrifying experience. First, you know, the woman, you know, she's been raped, she's traumatized. There's not even a system. You know, on paper, India is a very sophisticated system. In the state where I come from, suddenly it was announced that there are going to be women-only police stations in a majority of the districts. Wow, that's great. But in reality, it's only on paper. What is going on in this, you don't know. So it's very intimidating. So at the end of it, what does a rape victim do? Doesn't go to the police station. And even if she goes, she might be further harassed sexually, physically. Even the comments, you might not be sexually harassed, but the way they treat her, so this is a problem. In Seva, what we found is that they always go as a group, you know, and I talked about this power, which they go and they know how to talk. So they know how to talk, they will tell that policeman, if you don't do this, we are going to approach somebody higher up for you. You know, and obviously, even in a corrupt system, there are some people who still work, right? That's why the country is functioning somehow. So it's this, and so when I talk about Seva, they say it's a union, it's a cooperative, but it's also much bigger than that. It's also collective bargaining, not just for economic sense, but social bargaining, human rights bargaining that they constantly do. A group, you know, and they know how to talk. And it didn't come in a day, you know, it came through generations. They have also got very strong channels. So, you know, it's the system. They are living and they are working and they are succeeding in the system, which is interesting for us to follow. And, you know, that's why when we thought of this project, we kind of thought of tapping into this organization, you know, that organization sphere, and to see how they are dealing with domestic violence.
Well, Shoma actually has a back meeting too,
Yeah.
So let us give her another
Thank you.